This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll find out how chest pain can be a real emergency and how compassionate rounds for healthcare providers can create a healing environment for all. But first, how to improve the immunization rates for low-income kids. Childhood vaccinations have clearly saved lives, both here and throughout the world, protecting children from serious and life-threatening diseases. But while overall immunization rates have been high in this country, there remain some groups for which this is not the case. And here to tell us more about this and what can be done about it are Dr. Joseph Domokowski, professor of pediatrics as well as of microbiology and immunology, and Dr. Monica Suryadevara, assistant professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in. Dr. Domokowski, there are groups of kids who are under-vaccinated in this country. Tell us who they are.
Well, there are several different groups. We have groups of culturally sort of resistant.
Who basically refuse to have their kids vaccinated on religious grounds?
Religious or cultural grounds.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And what do we do about that? What do you think is causing this? Besides, if it's a belief system, I understand, but there have been of late kind of trends of parents who feel like there's something in the vaccine that could be hazardous to their kids.
So I see those as an even separate group. I see those as philosophical sort of exemptors. People that, for whatever reason, have decided that the vaccines are either safe or unnecessary for their kids. And when I talk to those families, they have a lot of different reasons that they tell me.
But isn't there a problem with this in terms of the whole herd immunity concept? In other words, if a lot of people opt out of vaccinating their children for whatever grounds, doesn't it affect all of us?
Well, we've proven that it affects all of us because we've experienced very recent outbreaks of vaccine-preventable infections.
Why do you think some of these people, I know that there's been this issue of autism, but I think it's been postulated that perhaps parents have not experienced, that generation has not experienced the devastation that some of these really serious diseases like polio, for example, could cause.
Agreed. I think not too long ago, we at least had the help of the grandparents that could remind the new parents about what these infections really were. And, we've gotten so far away from many of these vaccine-preventable diseases, at least as major problems, public health problems, that even grandparents now, new grandparents, don't remember what those were, so they can't help educate their kids. So as providers, it's our duty to remind people about what those infections can do.
And are you having any success with convincing people?
Well, it depends on the rationale that the parents are giving us for not vaccinating. If they need information and education, we can get them to vaccinate their kids every time. But if they give us sort of philosophical reasons that we can't understand and we don't share that same philosophy, those are the more resistant families.
So it continues. It's something that's really hard to combat. How about HPV? I know you were on the show not too long ago. We were talking about the new recommendation for boys as well as girls to be vaccinated for human papillomavirus and the potential for the diseases it can cause.
Right. When the HPV vaccines were first approved back in 2006, we were only vaccinating females. But in 2011, the vaccine recommendation was expanded to include boys and young men. And we still see a discrepancy between the percentage of young females and young boys, young males that are vaccinated.
And what's the potential problem with that, with under-vaccinating that population?
Well, again, this is a transmittable virus, and that transmittable virus can infect both boys and girls, and once they have experienced behavior that allows transmission, they can spread that virus. That HPV virus, as we talked about last time, is a cancer-causing infection.
I think that's the key, that it really can cause cancer, and this is one way to really prevent it in advance. Dr. Suryadevara, is there are also poor kids are not getting vaccinated.
Right. The kids who don't have money or access to resources aren't getting vaccinated. And right. there are two separate reasons why that may be the case. One is access to vaccine. A lot of families have trouble finding transportation to get to their doctor's office or can't take time off from work. And those kids aren't even able to access the vaccine. And there's another group where the family isn't educated enough or doesn't know enough about the vaccines and either doesn't know that the vaccine is recommended for their child or is concerned that there are safety issues with the vaccine.
And this clearly just adds to that whole concern for the fact that all of those kids, for whatever the reason, are also not getting their full vaccinations.
Correct.
And also, does that affect or potentially affect our herd immunity, so to speak, or the rest of us?
Correct. You have a whole community of children who aren't getting vaccinated either for access reasons or for education reasons, decreasing herd immunity in the community.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Drs. Domokowski and Surya Devera. And we are talking about the need to improve immunization rates in some children in this country. So as you said, these kids who are impoverished are not getting vaccinated properly. You recently published a study on that. Tell us about it.
Yes. So what we found looking in previous studies is that the two main reasons why impoverished children aren't getting vaccinated is lack of access to vaccine and lack of education about vaccine. So we wanted to develop a program to improve both access and education to vaccine.
So what did you do?
So we met families at the Salvation Army who are accessing this community-based organization for non-medical reasons. They were registering for a gift distribution program for their families, and we thought that'd be a great way to access a large number of families with impoverished children.
That's very clever, actually. When you say we did it, tell us a little bit more about your team.
We, being the study team, which involved two pediatric infectious disease specialists and a health educator, and multiple medical students who helped administer vaccines.
Okay, so after you contacted Salvation Army in this case, what did you do?
We met. We attended the gift distribution registration. It was a two-week period. Happened at different sites around Syracuse. And we talked to families individually. We met each family individually. We asked them questions regarding their understanding of routine pediatric vaccines, what their beliefs of the safety and efficacy were of the vaccines, whether they themselves got vaccinated, what they thought of each individual vaccine, including flu vaccine. And then after we collected this information, we accessed their child's immunization records in the computer to determine whether their child was vaccine complete or vaccine delayed based upon recent recommendations.
So your goal was really to improve the vaccination rates, but what was the study? In other words, what were you attempting to study?
So our study was, if we educate the families, will that increase their child's vaccination rate? So after we collected our survey information and compared that with the immunization records, we were able to address each family's individual concern regarding vaccine, educate them as to what vaccine the child was due for, and how to go about getting those child vaccinations.
Now, we mentioned earlier the other populations who are not getting vaccinated for other reasons. Did you find some of the same objections when you were interviewing these lower-income families?
There were a few families who had some philosophical exemptions. However, the majority of the families were able to be educated, and once they understood the reasons for the vaccine recommendations, they were more likely to have their child vaccinated.
So basically, your point of access or your contact point was through the Salvation Army gift program.
Correct.
And then you identified the families. You engaged in some educational programming. You found out which of their children, were not being adequately vaccinated, and then what?
And then we offered on-site influenza vaccine and pneumococcal vaccine to those eligible. The pneumococcal vaccine was for the children who were less than six, and the influenza vaccine was for any child as well as any family member to show that we really believed in influenza, pneumococcal vaccine in particular.
Yeah, why those two?
It was in the middle of influenza season, so it was a perfect time to offer vaccine to a community who otherwise would have a harder time accessing vaccine. And pneumococcal vaccine also has been shown to have reduced uptake in this particular population.
So they were also not getting that kind of vaccine.
Much,
and is that also crucial in terms of
correct.
Preventing
as
pneumonia?
As pneumococcus is the most common bacterial cause of pneumonia, ear infections, sinus infections.
So in a sense, what did you find?
So what we found was prior to our educational intervention, only 28% of the children were completely vaccinated.
In other words, they'd had their full range of childhood
vaccinations.
Full everything
that the ACIP recommended they had completed.
ACIP.
And, yep. The
American Academy? No.
It's the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices.
Oh, okay.
That's the group that puts out the recommendations for the vaccine.
Yes, and?
And the reason why it was only 28% who were vaccine complete was because of the lack of influenza vaccine. When you took out influenza vaccine, 70% of the children had completed all the other vaccines. So what that showed us is that the reason why a lot of children are vaccine delayed is because they're not getting their influenza vaccine.
So that seems to be the culprit more
exactly.
than anything. It's interesting because now it's being offered so widely at supermarkets and drugstores as well as doctor's offices. Do you think that's is making a difference or will make a difference?
When you go to supermarkets and drug offices and non-medical practices, those are mostly for adults. So it's harder to find places for children to get vaccinated. You have to schedule an appointment at the doctor's office. If you have multiple children in your family, they may make you come on to separate days. So I found that access to flu vaccine for the children was one big reason why kids didn't get vaccinated. The second reason was because a lot of families are concerned that if children are getting the flu vaccine, we're giving them the flu, and that it's just going to make them sick. That was the most common reason for parents to decline flu vaccine.
So that was another issue of education.
Correct. And so as we educated the families, they became more willing to get their children to receive the flu vaccine.
So in summary, what did you find?
We found that providing vaccine access for the families at a place where they're already accessing other services in combination with individual education to help them understand more about vaccine safety and efficacy was effective in increasing immunization rates in this community, particularly with the flu vaccine.
So basically, education and access made the difference with that population. Dr. Demichelski, how do you see that factor, those two factors perhaps affecting other parts? First of all, how does that compare to other parts of the country?
Well, first of all, our observation here impressed us so much that we decided to continue to do this each year.
So
the collaboration's fantastic. So we're going to continue this as we go forward.
With the Salvation Army or with other not-for-profit?
With the Salvation Army, because they are among the largest, at least for accessing the children.
Here in Central New York.
And I would hope that after reading our pediatrics manuscript, our published research, that other areas of the country.
What journal could we find that in?
It's in Pediatrics in August of 2013.
Okay.
It was published just last month.
And you're hoping that after people read it?
Yeah, we're hoping that as other people that are interested in vaccine delivery and utilization of vaccines across the country.
In underserved populations.
That they can use this model and either expand it with the Salvation Army or other community-based organizations to allow better delivery of some of these vaccines.
So basically what you're saying is if we can partner with organizations throughout the country, these kinds of organizations, that we might be able to really improve the level of vaccination of children in this country on the whole in that regard.
It won't solve the whole problem, but it's one of the steps toward a solution.
Very, very good. Well, I want to thank you so much. This has been very, very interesting information, very wonderful research, and it's led to some further program that you're going to offer to our community where everyone will benefit, and hopefully maybe even throughout the country people will pick up on this idea. My guests have been Dr. Joseph Domikowski, Professor of Pediatrics, as well as Microbiology and Immunology, and Dr. Monica Surya-Devara, the Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University. Next up, why you should never ignore that pain in your chest. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here. For this week's What's Your Emergency segment, Dr. Derek Cooney sat down with Dr. Christian Knudsen to talk about chest pain.
Today we're talking about chest pain, and I'm joined by Dr. Christian Knudsen, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine and Medical Director of the EMS Education Programs at SUNY Upstate Medical University. Chest pain can occur for many reasons and may start at any time of day or night, leading to the need to see a doctor. Many times this means a confusing and uncomfortable trip to the hospital with many concerns and questions about the causes and what might happen next. As we learn today, in today's segment, there are a lot of causes of chest pain, but not all of them are life-threatening. Unfortunately, it may take some work on the part of the doctors and medical team at the hospital to determine the cause. Dr. Knutson, what kind of chest pain is there, and what are we talking about here?
Chest pain is a difficult symptom to assess sometimes. There are lots of different types of chest pain. The one classically you see on TV or if you watch movies is someone who has acute heart attack where a person will grab their chest, have squeezing or heavy chest pain. Pain goes to their jaw, goes to their arm, goes to their back. They get sweaty, lightheaded, and weak. And that's the very typical story of a bad heart attack. And that's the worst case scenario. There are lots of other causes, problems of chest pain, whether it be heartburn, burning in the chest, pneumonia, shortness of breath and a cough with chest pain, muscle strain, people who work too hard to do hard jobs for a living and cause chest pain with that, and blood clots in the lung, which are clots usually from the legs that go to lungs and cause pain and shortness of breath as well. So it's a very broad list of problems.
So when we see these patients in the emergency department, they do have different conditions to be considered. But what about the type of pain? Does it matter? Do we need to know what it feels like to them? Does it matter if it's sharp, dull, where it's located, or where it goes?
It does. Like I said, the typical heart attack is usually a squeezing or heaviness feeling in the chest. And it does go to the neck and the arms and the back sometimes. Some people may just have simple burning of the chest. You know, they eat spicy food. They have too much food on holidays. And they just have some mild burning or burping. That's important to know to differentiate serious heart attacks from heartburn. Or where the pain is, over the chest or the back or the sides also helps us as well.
Is it possible for someone to say, oh, well, I know this has got to be heartburn because I took some Mylanta and it went away, so I'm not going to worry at all? Or is it a little more complicated than that?
It can be more complicated. Oftentimes, people with early heart attacks or mild heart attacks or elderly people can just have heartburn symptoms as the symptom of their heart attack. That's why it can be so hard to tell who's very sick or who's not when you come to the ER sometimes. Typically, there are some other symptoms with it. People who have heartburn symptoms that don't get better with taking Tums or antacids will get a little shortness of breath and symptoms, the neck, the arm, the back pain, lightheadedness or weakness that aren't typical for heartburn, maybe something more serious.
So those pains can be with it. So they have chest pain or chest discomfort, right? Because it doesn't necessarily have to be pain of any kind. And you're saying if it's associated with neck pain or jaw pain or back pain or arm pain, that may mean to them, to you in the emergency department, that in fact that's a little more serious. That's probably not some simple issue that could be an over-the-counter medication to take care of. That probably requires further evaluation. I hate to belabor this point, but you know what? I think this is important to talk about. When we say this all the time, what is a heart attack? Because there's chest pain, there's heart attack, and then there's cardiac arrest. And I think, unfortunately, when we talk about these things, we sometimes, interchange them. But really, we mean something different when we say heart attack. What do you mean when you mean, say, heart attack?
When we say heart attack, we mean there is a blockage in the arteries of the heart, which is either slowing down or stopping blood going to the muscle of the heart. And there can be different degrees of heart attacks. We call angina. People who walk and get chest pain, and they get heart attack symptoms, and then they sit down or stop, and those go away. That's usually a sign of a blockage that's slowly getting worse. Versus someone who is doing an activity, playing golf, walking down the street, who gets a sudden onset of chest pain and the other heart attack symptoms. We think of a sudden blockage where a clot forms in their arteries, and there's a very sudden blockage of blood flow to the heart. And that's very serious.
And that's stopping the oxygen to getting to the muscle and could cause permanent damage and maybe even that next step, cardiac arrest.
Right. When the heart is very sensitive to oxygen delivery, and when it does not have oxygen, it does not work well. So once the blood's flow stops, it's very time dependent. So the longer the lack of oxygen goes, the more heart damage there could be. And it could go from just damage of the heart wall, so it won't pump as well, up until the whole heart stops beating. Patients lose pulses, and they have a cardiac arrest. They lose consciousness and don't have any pulses.
And that's time to get 911, do CPR, and we need an AED, don't we?
We do. Well, people need 911 activated quickly, hands-only CPR, where bystanders can start doing CPR. They don't have to worry about doing mouth-to-mouth breathing, but just hands-only CPR until EMS arrives is crucial, and is getting an AED. Very common in supermarkets, banks, churches, public places, usually very well marked, or people know where they are if you ask people who work there. An early attachment of the AED with CPR has saved lives.
And a lot of times that starts with chest pain, so this is a really important thing to be talking about. And you work at a PCI center. What's a PCI center?
PCI centers are places where they can do coronary catheterizations quickly.
What does that mean?
So if you have a clot in your heart and heart arteries, which blocks blood flow, we have cardiologists who can come in. The ER doctors will see you. They will get an EKG immediately, recognize you're having a heart attack, will call a cardiologist in immediately, and very quickly you go from the ER up to a cardiac care suite, and they place a tube that goes in through your artery of your thigh usually, and they pass wires into your heart, find the blockage, and either put a stent or a balloon in to get that blockage to go away.
So that's not at every hospital. That's specific hospitals. And so that's something that's been shown to be very important to do quickly. Now, you're a medical director for ambulances and fire departments. What do you tell people about what's going to happen when that ambulance gets there? Because presumably you have chest pain that's significant. They're going to call 911. Ambulance is going to show up. And the hope is that they're going to get to, if they're having a major heart attack, then they're going to get this PCI, this percutaneous coronary intervention, which is when they go into those arteries of the heart and open it up so the blood and oxygen can get there. What about what's going to happen with let's say your fire department ambulance gets there? What's going to happen next?
The paramedics and EMTs are all trained to recognize heart attack symptoms. So either mild up to severe symptoms, they will recognize what's going on. They'll do an EKG using their cardiac monitors either in the house or in the ambulance.
So that's sort of that's an electrical tracing of what's going on in the heart.
Right. So they can quickly recognize heart attacks, and they'll treat you for the pain. They'll put an IV in place to give you fluids to help support your blood pressure. They'll give you nitroglycerin, usually a tab or a spray under the tongue to help the chest pain go away. And most importantly, give you aspirin. 2 or 4 baby aspirin has been shown to decrease the death rate from heart attacks. So whether someone at home takes aspirin or the paramedics will give you aspirin or the ER will give you aspirin when you're seen. So you can expect a lot of things to be done to you, IV, EKG, and some medicines to get you better. And the paramedics will, of course, take you somewhere where they can do these heart interventions if they recognize a heart attack.
What if let's say I'm out and about and I'm with my loved one and they are having chest pain and we have our car. Is there some reason why people should know they shouldn't try to drive themselves or drive their family member or friend to the hospital? Obviously, it sounds like there's a lot going on, but what other risks are there to just trying to drive to the hospital?
People, for some reason, don't like calling for ambulances because they feel like they're being a bother. But for chest pain, it is crucial to call for an ambulance. If your loved one is driving you and you get sicker in the car, you can't receive any treatment. If your heart suddenly stops, if your chest pain gets worse, you pass out, one, you can't receive care, and two, if someone, your loved one's driving you, they may be paying more attention to you than driving the car. And there's always a chance of getting a car accident. If you call for an ambulance, they can take care of you, keep you safe, get you the best care possible while taking you to the hospital safely.
What about when we call the ambulance and the ambulance gets there and our loved one says, well, I don't want to go to the hospital. This is chest pain. It'll pass. What do we do then?
Well, we...
And how do we explain that?
Well, I think the paramedics, EMTs, in conversation with the patient or speaking to the doctors at the hospital, talk with the patient and tell them the worst-case scenario. If this is a true heart attack, you need health care right away. This is not something you want to wait for to see your doctor the next day for. If you call your doctor, they'll tell you the same thing. Go to the hospital, get blood tests, get an EKG, get your pain treated, and likely be admitted to the hospital for further care and tests. So when people don't want to go to the hospital, that's the worst thing you can do. The paramedics and the family should really push their loved ones to get care right then.
So significant chest pain, we call 911, the ambulance takes us straight to a hospital designated to take care of this for us because time matters. We don't want to lose heart muscle. But what if they get there and they say, well, this isn't. Well, you get to the hospital and you get the test done, you get the electrocardiogram, mm-hmm. you get the blood test, you get the chest x-ray, and then they say, well, it's not, what if I say, well, is it a heart attack? And they say, well, it's not a heart attack, but we're going to meet you at the hospital anyway. Why would I get admitted to the hospital anyway?
There are some limitations to the tests we do in the emergency department. One of the big tests we do is a heart test called troponin. It's a blood test to look for heart damage. And that test may not rise right away if you had a heart attack. It may take hours for us to find a change in that blood test. So if you come to the hospital and you have an EKG where you're not having a large heart attack, or your x-ray looks good, your blood test has not changed yet, we still want to keep you in the hospital to do more tests, follow that troponin level, and maybe get a stress test the next day so that if we find a problem, we can take care of it during that admission.
And during that admission, if they find something, then cardiologists are available. There's an intensive care unit specifically for heart problems, right?
Yes.
And then there's the cath lab, that catheterization lab, in case it turns out there is a blockage of the artery.
And hopefully you come in, you stay, there's no problems, you go home the next day. But if there is a true problem and we find other issues, you're kept safe, and we get you care quickly.
What are the other things? I mean, you're doing a lot of testing in the emergency department, and we specifically talked about heart attacks, but what are the other things that cause chest pain that you might discover that if you don't go to the emergency department, you wouldn't know you had and could be treated?
I think the three things we have to watch out for: pneumonia. Typically, if other symptoms we watch out for, the chest pain, the shortness of breath, and a fever. Some people can have a collapsed lung called a pneumothorax. While rare, it is life-threatening, and you need care right away to treat that. It's something called a pulmonary embolism. Again, clots in your legs, your arms that go to your lungs. That could be a little more tricky to diagnose. And that, if it goes unrecognized, could lead to worse problems.
All right, so there's some other life-threatening things. And then there's things like pneumonia that maybe we could treat and
yes.
let you go home.
Absolutely.
I'm Dr. Derek Cooney, and my guest today was Dr. Christian Knutson. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. You know, the biggest and most urgent nutritional question of our time, what should I eat, happens to have the greatest assortment of confusing and contradictory answers. But we know that not all foods are equal. There are qualitative differences. And here in our Healthy Eats segment, with some thoughts about the concept of the quality of foods, is Upstate nutritionist Terry Podalek. Hey, Terry. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Linda. Thank you.
So what do we mean when we talk about the quality of foods with regard to food?
You know, nutrition should be stress-free, but everybody needs to think of the word whole and whole foods. Which are foods from nature that have not been overly processed by people. Food in its natural form, less refined. So the word whole food means, again, just food that's higher in fiber, better nutrition. A processed food has less fiber, less nutrition, may have added sugars, added sugar substitutes.
Maybe added chemicals for preservatives and all of that.
Exactly. A long list of ingredients, where whole foods, very, very few list of ingredients.
So in general, whole foods mean things that have not been processed or humans haven't monkeyed with it too much.
Exactly.
But how does that relate to organic? Because those are two little bit different things.
Right. Most whole foods, I think, are organic. So.
But organic means not grown with pesticides.
Right.
But a potato, theoretically, could be grown with pesticides or not, and that's a whole food.
Right. So we do need to look for, when you can, to look for an organic potato, but if you can't, then if it would fit your budget to eat a regular potato,
you should go ahead. So you've said that on other shows, actually. The importance here is we want to eat as many fruits and vegetables as we can, even if we can't afford so-called organic ones.
Exactly. Definitely for our health. So choosing fruits and vegetables over processed foods any day is much, much better.
I read somewhere that the actual content of our nutrients, or the nutrient content of some of our fruits and vegetables, are actually declining from way back because of all the use of fertilizers and getting things to grow more quickly, maybe even the use of pesticides.
Yes.
Is that
a
problem as well?
Exactly. So they say even the fertilizers that are making our plants grow so quickly, it's like fast food for our plants. So we want to think less fast food. There's a movement called the slow whole food movement where we want to slow down. We want to eat more locally produced foods, which are likely to not have as many pesticides. Those fruits and vegetables are going to be higher and better quality nutrition. And what they feel is that a lot of people, we need to choose quality over quantity. What they're concerned about is that a lot of people are eating greater quantities just to get the nutrients that they need.
Well, especially if they're less nutrient dense, if the food is less nutrient rich, it would seem to me to be able to fulfill yourself.
Exactly.
I read somewhere that you had to eat up to 3 apples to get the same amount of iron that you would normally get in a single apple grown in 1940.
Yes.
Well, so people are eating more, and that also probably adds to the obesity problem.
Exactly. So people really need to look for foods that are of better quality, such as that, and foods that are grown in better soil are having better nutrition.
You had a quote for me. Tell us what it is.
Yes, I did. From Michael Pollan, who's a food writer, one of my favorite authors, he says, "To gather, prepare, and enjoy food as a center of a well-lived life." So I think we need to look at putting our hearts back into eating slower, creating healthier menus, and think about a relationship with food all the way from the soil to our meals.
Thanks, Terry. That's inspiring.
Thank
you. Thanks so much. Coming up, how compassion is the key ingredient, not just for the patients, but for the healers as well. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Boggy, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for October 7th. Pick proper portions. Restaurants want to give you more for your money, but the portions they serve are often much more than anyone should eat in one sitting. Restaurant foods also tend to be overloaded with salt, fat, sugar, and calories, which can lead to weight gain. You can cut calories before they arrive at the table by foregoing the bread basket, asking for a child size or half order, or making your own meal out of the side salads, soups, steamed veggies, and appetizers. If you do get a full-size entree, listen to your body's natural cues and stop eating when you're full. It's important not to overindulge simply because you're eating out. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Effective communication is the foundation of any healthcare team, and poor and non-existent communication among healthcare professionals can often negatively impact on patient care, especially today when the stresses of today's healthcare system threaten the delivery of compassionate care. We'll hear with more on some new efforts to address this is Reverend Virginia Lawson, ordained in the Rinzai Zen Buddhist tradition, who serves as an interfaith chaplain at Upstate Medical University. Welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here.
So there's a new effort underway to address this whole idea of healthcare providers communicating.
Yes, that's correct. It's the Short Center Rounds. Started about 10 years ago out of a hospital in Boston by a young man, Mr. Schwartz, who actually died of a cancer at the very early age, early 40s. And he was just so impressed by the compassionate care that he got, that he, before he died, made provision in his will for these compassionate care rounds to be begun. And there are in about 300 hospitals now around the country.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So you're beginning this here?
Yes, our second one will be December 3rd here at the hospital.
And tell us more about what happens. What exactly do we mean when we say compassionate care?
It's a focus. It fits right in with Upstate's patient-first philosophy. It's a focusing on the patient as a whole and the members of the team. And compassion is, you know, with passion, with being aligned with the patient as opposed to a hierarchical kind of thing, but emotionally, of course, maintaining a professional distance, but emotionally recognizing the patient as being whole and complete, but also recognizing everybody in that multidisciplinary team as still needing this, being able to communicate, being able to talk about, being able to share feelings and compassion. So being able to recognize the fed compassion in each other.
So the idea here is that all the members of the team are basically better able to be in touch with their own emotions and therefore be able to share in the emotions of the patient and do a better job caregiving?
Exactly. Not only exactly that, but also recognizing the emotions of the other people who are on the team, recognizing the humanist, the humane between doctors, nurses, all members, the housekeeping who are very much involved in long-term, you know, they know the patients, they see the patients in long-term care and such, and security and all. So it's multidisciplinary. It's not only clinical, though clinical is the focus of the of our particular funder, but it actually, the Schwartz Compassionate Care Rounds specifically are for all members, all disciplines within the hospital.
So it really is to try to make it a very kind of, a lot of equanimity, a lot of equalness amongst all of the players mm-hmm. in the setting.
Yeah, a recognition.
Patient, doctor, mm-hmm. nurse.
Yeah, recognition of going beyond roles. Not interacting as roles, but interacting as we're all together on this team and we're really all focused on this patient and on the patient family.
How did this come to be here at Upstate?
We have, there was a doctor here, Dr. Dan Burdick, and he was very much interested in this idea, not the compassionate rounds by name, because he wrote about this 25 years ago, but he was very interested and he was focusing on physicians, he being a physician, focusing on physicians recognizing their feelings and not stuffing it, but actually recognizing their feelings, talking with other physicians, talking with other people, bringing it out so that they could provide this humane, compassionate care. Dr. Burdick died, but his children created a fund, and that's the seed money. This is our very first year with our very first program coming up on October 1st, and they provided the seed money, and we're going ahead. We're going to present six of these programs.
Wow. You know, if you're just joining us, we're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Reverend Virginia Lawson, and she's one of the interfaith chaplains at Upstate Medical University. And we're talking about Compassionate Rounds, which is a new program to facilitate healthcare provider communications. But it sounds like more than communications. It sounds like emotional sensitivity overall.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the missions of the spiritual care department is to support staff as well as being here for families and patients. And this is a support for staff. What one does in these Schwartz Center rounds is to focus on a particular case that's been stressful. And people, it's not a root cause, what went wrong, what can we do different.
It's not like grand rounds.
No, it's not, even though it is a grand rounds formula or a platform. No, it's not. It's not
looking so much at the underlying clinical issues. It's looking more specifically on the emotional content.
It's looking more exactly. This is what happened and this is what I felt. This is what happened and this is what I wish could have happened, but it's not trying to solve a problem. It's a safe place. Confidentiality is stressed. It's a safe place to talk about what your feelings were. And that's how, at least the research has shown over the last 10 years, that's how a closer team is built, by recognizing, what comes out almost naturally is recognizing other people on the team as being concerned, and also that it breaks down isolation and stress.
So take us through it. How does it start? I mean, give us an example of what an example of how the rounds work.
Okay, we have a planning committee. I have 12 people on our planning committee. They are
doctors. And you are the coordinator.
I am the coordinator. We have a facilitator who is Reverend Terry Culbertson, who is the director of the spiritual care department. We have a physician champion, which is a title that the Schwartz Round has, and that's Dr. Colleen O'Leary. She's an anesthetologist and a teacher in that department. And then we have several doctors, social work, continuing care.
So you have a representative.
I have 15 different representatives, and they're people who can get the word out.
But how does actually give? I mean, take us into a rounds. Let us be a fly on the wall. What actually transpires?
Okay, our first topic is going to be when you're overwhelmed by a non-compliant patient and family conflict. So it's a real case, and the people who were involved in it are invited to attend, and the people who are involved in it, we're using three people, are on what's the panel who will give the setup, and they speak for 3 to 5 minutes, and they give, there's a doctor, and she will give the clinical sort of details, and then we have a social worker and a nurse.
So they lay out, first what they do is they lay out what happened.
Exactly.
But then what happens?
Well, they lay out their perception of what happened with their emotional response, and then the facilitator opens it to the audience. So most of the time is spent on audience saying, yes, I was involved and this was the frustration, or I wasn't involved with this young man, but I've been involved with other ones and this is how I felt, or this brought up my brother who it broke my heart because he wasn't compliant, or any of those things. And that's it. That's the talking it through, the sharing of experience, then at the end the facilitator summing it up, and they last for an hour.
So it's almost like I hesitate to use this word, but almost like an emotional support group.
Absolutely.
For all of the people involved in the care of sick patients.
Absolutely, yes. Because, as I said, we do involve housekeeping, security, especially in this particular case, all the people who were involved or possibly were involved, yes.
Where else is this happening?
Well, here in town, St. Joe's has been doing it for, I think, 4 or 5 years, and the Veterans Administration over at the VA, they've been doing it, I think, for 2 years. And we're doing it in our fiscal year, 6 programs our fiscal year, every other month.
Wow.
So we've done one October 1st. We'll be doing one December 3rd.
And you said that there are over 300 healthcare facilities throughout the United States that are doing
this?
Yes,
the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom.
That seems amazing to me. It seems the direction that we need to be taking,
especially
as we get, I don't know, as healthcare systems become larger in a sense and potentially more depersonalized, it seems like this is an important balancer.
I believe so, and I really was really impressed when we were reviewing it, because Dr. Coleman was one at the Cancer Center. Dr. Leslie Coleman, yes. She was one of the first to attempt to bring this, and it was the family of Dr. Burdick was in contact with her. And actually our first rounds are going to be an oncology round sort of to honor him and his work. But I was really impressed by the materials that are on their website. That's the Schwartz Center Rounds website.
We'll have a link to that on our website as well.
Wonderful, because they have videos that have testimony talking from doctors, nurses, people who've participated in these, but there's been independent research, and one of the clearest, one of the reasons that it's so good, I think, is that one of the problems, one of the issues with healthcare workers is the stress and isolation felt, not just by physicians, but by a number, level of frustration with patients who will not comply. And this stress and this isolation, it's just plain not healthy, for one thing, but it also affects performance. And research, they had independent research done, shows that the stress is much, much lessened, that even indirectly, patient satisfaction goes up in the hospitals where this is.
So just by the act of sharing?
It's amazing. Just by the act of sharing, the act of knowing you're not alone.
Do you find, or have you found in looking over the research, that some people are more reluctant than others, perhaps, to engage in this kind of sharing? It would seem that might be one of your potential...
Yes.
challenges.
It is, absolutely. That's why our planning committee is so important. The people on the planning committee are, quite frankly, people of influence. And part of their duty is to informally talk it up among the physicians, among their other their colleagues, to encourage. Another encouragement is that we do continuing medical education units. Both doctors and nurses can earn them for this. That's recognized nationally for that. Apparently what happens is it's a building. People come, they talk, they go out, they share, they recognize the confidentiality. They don't say, this person said blah, blah, blah. It's, this is what was said, and it builds. So it's
In other words, the first one might not. You might be a little bit in a little bit of a chill over the whole situation, but the hope would be over time people would warm up to it, be more comfortable with sharing, mm-hmm. and that actually it would almost kind of snowball in a positive direction.
Yes, and I really believe that it will. Given every person that we invited to be on the planning committee, not only did they respond yes, they responded enthusiastically. Some of them with the "It's about time." Yes, I'm waiting for this. I was really overwhelmed with the kind of absolute openness of sharing of just about everyone. And there were two people who we invited who were not able because of schedules, and they recommended other people who did accept. So I'm really encouraged. It's like, come and taste and see this is good, and then I'm encouraged.
It sounds like it's going to be an incredible addition to what is offered at Upstate in the culture that's already there. But I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing all of that with us. I mean, it's very interesting. So this is the Schwartz Compassionate Rounds.
Our second one will be December 3rd, Tuesday, and that will deal with a very tough sickle cell case.
I hope you'll come back and report on the results and
let
us know how it
to.
Went. It would be wonderful. Well, thank you so much. My guest has been Reverend Virginia Lawson. She is a ordained in the Rinzai Zen Buddhist tradition, and she is also an interfaith chaplain at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse, with this week's selection. Traumatic brain injuries impact not only the person who suffers them, but also those who love and care for them. I'd like to read an excerpt of a very powerful short story that we were sent by a writer from Nova Scotia. Her name is Carol Glasser Longueuil. Her story is called Who Are You? And it describes the long and painful way back from the point of view of a father whose adult daughter was in a terrible automobile accident. Who are you? Mr. Mercier, alone in the bed he used to share with his wife, does not sleep anymore. These days he leaves the blinds open, and when the moon is bright, he looks out at the copse of trees at the back of the yard. They have such a fragile beauty, he thinks. He can't bear to think of his daughter, who isn't able to keep her head from falling over when she sits on the couch, saliva dripping from her mouth. What will become of her? He feels a quivering anxiety in his stomach. He didn't know sadness could be so physical, but he never lets his wife see him cry. Liz has no memory of her 4-year-old daughter Andrea, or her husband Ron for that matter, or the accident that happened on a perfectly fine day when they were driving to the city and a truck slammed into the passenger side of the car. Ron was not hurt, though surely there are scars Mr. Mercier can't see. Betty shows Liz photos of Andrea over and over again and says, "This is your little girl." Mr. Mercier knew things would be hard, and he is not one to complain, but then things get harder. It seems Ron can't continue taking care of Andrea. He's at work all day, and babysitters are unreliable. Can the Merciers take her? Ron is a psychologist, yet with all his fancy qualifications, the man can't face his own afflicted wife. He does not go into the house when he drops Andrea off. Betty takes Andrea's hand and turns her back on Ron as she climbs up the back steps. When Andrea sees her mother lying in bed moaning, not even glancing at her, the little girl cries. "It's okay now," Mr. Mercier says, lifting his granddaughter in his arms and taking her out of the room. "Your mommy is not herself, but she will be. She will be." It is March when Liz is well enough to take a walk with Mr. Mercier. The months go by. It feels unchristian to say what he thinks of her husband. But it's a sweet reward when one day his daughter has a breakthrough. They had gone to get the mail earlier and picked up a few bills. In the evening, he was sitting at the kitchen table writing a check. As he finishes signing his name, Liz walks over. She stares at his signature and mouths the words, Michael Mercier. She looks at the man who has written the name. You are my father, she says, and starts to cry. Now, Liz, darling, he says. He stares helplessly as she sobs. I am your dad, and you are my... For a moment, he's at a loss to speak. You're my beloved daughter, he says, so softly she can barely hear. Who would believe what a signature could do? I'm sorry, Liz says, still crying. For what? Not knowing you're my father. But you know now, he says. Rejoice greatly, he thinks. Had he put his signature on a check worth $1 million, it wouldn't have meant as much.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.